welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is part two of Starlin's Willing Executioners by Professor Kevin MacDonald. Were Jewish radicals Jews? Sleskin recounts the vast overrepresentation of Jews in the radical left in Europe and America. His attempts to explain this cover some familiar ground. Jewish intellectual opposition to the status quo, resulting from their marginal social status, such as Thorsten Veblen. Jewish leftism as a secular, universalized form of traditional Jewish messianism and rationalism, in which Jewish leftists are descendants of the Old Testament prophets calling for social justice. Lev Sternberg, the Dean of Soviet Anthropologists. Jewish communists as recreating traditional Jewish culture forms, especially scriptural interpretation and intense teacher-student relationships, in a communist setting. Historian Jaff Skatz. Sleskin's own contribution is to argue that Jewish radicals were in revolt against their families, rejecting the world of their fathers because it seemed to embody the connection between Judaism and anti-socialism, understood as commercialism, tribalism, and patriarchy. The real reason for their common revulsion was the feeling that capitalism and Jewishness were one and the same thing. Most Jewish rebels did not fight the state in order to become free Jews. They fought the state in order to become free of Jewishness, and thus free. This is a very useful theory, of course. Useful because it denies that Jewish radicals were Jews at all, that in fact they were anti-Jews, if not anti-Semites, and there's the rub. When Sleskin then goes on to recount the Jewish role as an elite in the most murderous regime in European history, we are led to believe that the only connection of those Jews with Jewishness is genealogical. Russian Jewish radicals, lovers of Pushkin and Tolstoy, as their counterparts in Poland, Hungary and Germany, loved Adam Mickiewicz, Sandor Petoffi and Goethe, idealistically and selflessly set out to fashion a secular utopia of social justice by overcoming Apollonian backwardness, even as they rejected their Jewish origins and all things Jewish. His evidence for this is rather thin, but even in the examples Sleskin uses to illustrate his point, it is clear that these Jewish radicals hated everything about their national cultures, except for one or two literary figures. The rest would have to go. As Exhibit A, Sleskin presents Georg Lukacs, the son of a prominent Jewish capitalist, who describes his profound discontent with his father's way of life. But Lukacs also expresses his hatred for the whole of official Hungary. How he extended his unhappiness with his father to cover the whole of Magyar life and Magyar history and Magyar literature indiscriminately, save for Petoffi. All else, the people and the culture would have to go, by mass murder if necessary. Lazar Kaganovich, the most prolific Jewish mass murderer of the Stalinist era, is pictured at the end of his life reading Pushkin, Tolstoy and Turgenev. But rather than see this as an aspect of traditional Jewish hatred for non-Jews and their culture, souped up and rationalized with a veneer of Marxism, Sleskin explains these radicals as enlightened Mercurians who wished to destroy the old culture, except for a few classics of modern literature. We may give thanks to know that Shakespeare would have survived the revolution. Another of Sleskin's examples is Lev Kopolev, a Soviet writer who witnessed and rationalized the Ukrainian famine as historical necessity. Sleskin states categorically that Kopolev did not identify as a Jew, but his own material indicates the complexity of the matter. Kopolev identified himself on Soviet documents as Jewish, but claimed that was only because he did not want to be seen as a cowardly apostate, and after World War II, because he did not want to renounce those who had been murdered for being Jewish. To the external world, Kopolev is a proud Jew, but to his close associates, in his heart of hearts, he is only a communist and a Soviet patriot. But of course, many of his close associates were ethnic Jews, and he shed no tears for the Ukrainian and Russian peasants and nationalists who were murdered in the name of international socialism, even as he mourned the loss of Jews murdered because they were Jews. By World War II, he had become a leading ideologue of Russian patriotism, developing an acute sense of hurt and injustice on behalf of Russia, Russian history, and the Russian word. As he attempted to rally the Russians to do battle with the Germans, Russian patriotism had suddenly become useful, much as, I would argue, harnessing the patriotism and high regard for military service among Americans has been useful for Jewish neoconservatives eager to rearrange the politics of the Middle East in the interests of Israel. Ideology is a wonderfully effective instrument in the service of self-deception, or deception. Probably more typical of the Jewish identity of the Bolsheviks is the account of Vitaly Rubin, a prominent philosopher and an ethnic Jew who recounted his career at a top Moscow school in the 1930s where over half the students were Jewish. Understandably, the Jewish question did not arise there. Not only did it not arise in the form of anti-Semitism, it did not arise at all. All the Jews knew themselves to be Jews, but considered everything to do with Jewishness a thing of the past. I remember thinking of my father's stories about his childhood, Heder, a Jewish elementary school, and traditional Jewish upbringing as something consigned to oblivion. None of that had anything to do with me. There was no active desire to renounce one's Jewishness. The problem simply did not exist. These Jews clearly have a Jewish identity, but they have been removed from traditional Jewish religious cultural forms. In such a predominantly Jewish milieu, there was no need to renounce their Jewish identity, and no need to push aggressively for Jewish interests, because they had achieved elite status. And yet, just prior to World War II, as Russians started replacing Jews among the political elite, and Nazism emerged as an officially anti-Jewish ideology, overt Jewish identity re-emerged. Following World War II, Israel began exerting its gravitational pull on Jews, much to the chagrin of a suspicious Stalin. The visit of Golda Meir in 1948 and the outpouring of Jewish support for Zionism that it aroused was a watershed event for Soviet Jewry. Stalin reacted to it by initiating a campaign against public Jews and Yiddish culture. It is interesting in this regard that the leading Soviet spokesmen on anti-Semitism were both ethnic Jews with non-Jewish sounding names, Emilian Yaroslavsky or Gubelman and Yuri Larin or Lurie. Both refer to Jews in the third person as if they themselves were not Jews. But when Larin tried to explain the embarrassing fact that Jews were preeminent, overabundant, dominant, and so on among the elite in the Soviet Union, he mentioned the unusually strong sense of solidarity and a predisposition towards mutual help and support. Ethnic networking, by any other name. Obviously, mutual help and support require that Jews recognize each other as Jews. Jewish identity may not have been much discussed, but it operated nonetheless, even if subconsciously, in the rarefied circles at the top of Soviet society. An example not presented by Slezkin is recounted in a report of 1950 to the Central Committee on Jewish activities at an aircraft production facility. In a number of extremely important departments of the Central Aero Hydrodynamic Institute, there are workers due to be substituted for political reasons. They gather around themselves people of the same nationality, impose the habit of praising one another, while making others erroneously believe that they are indispensable, and force their protégés through to high posts. Indeed, there is no other way to explain the extraordinary percentages of Jews throughout elite institutions, which became apparent when the purges began in the late 1940s. High IQ and achievement motivation can only go so far, and cannot explain why, for example, in the late 1940s, Jews made up 80% of the Soviet Academy of Science Institute of Literature. 42% of the directors of Moscow theatres, over half of Soviet circus directors, or 8 of the top 10 directors of the Bolshoi Theatre. In the case of Pushkin House, the opponents of the dominant clique stated that it had been forged by long-lasting relationships of families and friends, mutual protection, homogeneous Jewish national composition, and anti-patriotic or anti-Russian tendencies. The reality is that Jewish identity always becomes more salient when Jews feel threatened or feel that their interests as Jews are at stake, But Jewish identity becomes submerged when Jewish interests coincide with other interests and identities. This is a human universal, and presumably accounts for the fact that the American Founding Fathers felt no need to carefully define the cultural and ethnic parameters of their creation. They assumed the racial and cultural homogeneity of the Republic and perceived no threat to its control by themselves and their descendants. The relative submergence of Jewish identity within the Jewish milieu in elite circles of the Soviet Union during the 20s and 30s is a poor indicator of whether or not these people identified as Jews, or would do so when in later years Jewish and Soviet identities began to diverge, when National Socialism re-emphasized Jewish identity, or when Israel emerged as a beacon for Jewish identity and loyalty. A similar stance may be observed among present-day Jewish neocons, who argue that the United States has a deep interest in democratizing the Middle East. The confluence of their interests as Jews in promoting the policies of the Israeli right wing and their construction of American interests allows them to submerge or even deny the relevance of their Jewish identity whilst posing as American patriots. But if Israeli and American policy began to diverge significantly, Jewish interests would almost certainly control their attitudes and behavior. Indeed, since neoconservative Zionism of the Likud party variety is well known for promoting a confrontation between the US and the entire Muslim world, their policy recommendations best fit a pattern of loyalty to their ethnic group, not to America. In a previous work, I advanced several reasons for supposing that Jews continued to identify as Jews in the USSR, none of which is challenged by Slezkin's treatment. Number 1. Persons were classified as Jews depending on their ethnic background. At least partly because of residual anti-Jewish attitudes, this would tend to impose a Jewish identity on these individuals, and make it difficult to assume an exclusive identity as a member of a larger or more inclusive political group. Number 2. Many Jewish Bolsheviks, such as those in Evsekhtsaya, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, and the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, aggressively sought to establish a secular Jewish subculture. These phenomena are virtually ignored by Slezkin. Number 3. Very few Jews on the left envisioned a post-revolutionary society without a continuation of Judaism as a group. Indeed, the predominant ideology among Jewish leftists was that post-revolutionary society would end anti-Semitism, because it would end class conflict and the peculiar Jewish occupational profile. Number 4. The behavior of American communists shows that Jewish identity and the primacy of Jewish interests over communist interests were commonplace among individuals who were ethnically Jewish communists. And number 5. The existence of Jewish crypsis in other times and places was combined with the possibility that self-deception, identificatory flexibility, and identificatory ambivalence are important components of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. And in the end, despite the rationalizations of many Soviet Jews and Slezkin on Jewish identity, it was blood that mattered. By the time of World War II, most Jews knew that they were, in some sense, Jews. They may never have been to a synagogue, seen a menorah, heard Yiddish or Hebrew, tasted gefilte fish, or indeed met their grandparents. But they knew they were Jews in the Soviet sense, which was also, in essence, the Nazi sense. They were Jews by blood. They re-emerged as Jews to fight the Nazis, and to solicit the support of American Jews, to pressure their government to enter the war and provide aid to the Soviet Union. Jewish spokesmen visited New York, proclaiming that the Jewish people, ethnic or religious, communist, Zionist or traditionalist, were all of one family. Moreover, Slezkin leaves out an enormous amount of evidence that conflicts with his Jewish radicalism as patricide thesis, evidence indicating that in general Jewish radicals did identify as Jews and acted to promote specific Jewish interests. Certainly, Jewish radicals often rejected their father's religion and their way of life, but all the evidence points to their identifying in different ways as Jews, not losing their Jewish identity to become de-ethnicized moral crusaders against capitalism. Slezkin uses Franz Boas to illustrate his patricide theory because Boas was a radical Jew who recognized the shackles of tradition. But he fails to note that Boas was hardly in rebellion against his own family. Boas was reared in a Jewish liberal family in which the revolutionary ideals of 1848 remained influential. And there is ample evidence of his strong Jewish identification and concern with anti-Semitism. Besides a few individual cases like Lukács and Boas, the only general evidence that Slezkin provides for the patricide thesis comes from Jaff Skatz's study of the generation of Jewish communists who dominated the communist movement in Poland beginning in the 1930s. But it provides a mangled account of Skatz's work. These Jews did indeed reject their parents' religion, but the result of their Yiddish upbringing was a deep core of their identity, values, norms, and attitudes with which they entered the rebellious period of their youth and adulthood. This core was to be transformed in the processes of acculturation, secularization, and radicalization, sometimes even to the point of explicit denial. However, it was through this deep layer that all later perceptions were filtered. Most of these individuals spoke Yiddish in their daily lives and had only a poor command of Polish, even after joining the party. They socialized entirely with other Jews whom they met in the Jewish world of work, neighborhood, and Jewish social and political organizations. After they became communists, they dated and married among themselves, and their social gatherings were conducted in Yiddish. Their mentors and principal influences were other ethnic Jews, including especially Luxembourg and Trotsky, and when they recalled personal heroes, they were mostly Jews whose exploits achieved semi-mythical proportions. In general, Jews who joined the communist movement did not first reject their ethnic identity, and there were many who cherished Jewish culture and dreamed of a society in which Jews would be equal as Jews. It was common for individuals to combine a strong Jewish identity with Marxism, as well as various combinations of Zionism and Bundism, a movement of Jewish socialists. Moreover, the attraction of Polish Jews to communism was greatly facilitated by their knowledge that Jews had attained high-level positions of power and influence in the Soviet Union, and that the Soviet government had established a system of Jewish education and culture. In both the Soviet Union and Poland, communism was seen as opposing anti-Semitism. In marked contrast, during the 1930s, the Polish government enacted policies which excluded Jews from public sector employment, established quotas on Jewish representation in universities and the professions, and organized boycotts of Jewish businesses and artisans. Clearly, Jews perceived communism as good for Jews, and indeed a major contribution of Slezkin's book is to document that communism was good for Jews. It was a movement that never threatened Jewish group continuity, and it held the promise of Jewish power and influence, and the end of state-sponsored anti-Semitism. And when this group achieved power in Poland after World War II, they liquidated the Polish nationalist movement, outlawed anti-Semitism, and established Jewish cultural and economic institutions. Slezkin also fails to note that in the United States a strong Jewish identification was typical of Jewish radicals, and that Jewish support for the left typically waxed and waned depending on specifically Jewish issues, particularly those related to anti-Semitism and support for Israel. The Jewish Old Left was a recognized part of the Jewish community, and American Jewish leftists during the 1960s were the only leftists who did not reject their parents. They really were red diaper babies. It is also remarkable that the revolutionary movement in Tsarist Russia ceased being anti-Jewish when Jews attained highly visible and prominent positions in the movement, even though workers and peasants participated in anti-Jewish pogroms from 1880 to 1905 and continued to harbour anti-Jewish attitudes. As Slezkin himself notes, Jews were the only group that was not criticised by the revolutionary movement, even though most Russians, and especially the lower classes, whose cause they were supposedly championing, had very negative attitudes towards Jews. When in 1915 Maxim Gorky, a strong philo-Semite, published a survey of Russian attitudes towards Jews, the most common response was typified by the comment that the congenital, cruel and consistent egoism of the Jews is everywhere victorious over the good-natured, uncultured, trusting Russian peasant or merchant. There were concerns that all of Russia would pass into Jewish hands, and that Russians would become slaves of the Jews. In the end, as Sleskin shows, as a result of the revolution, this prediction was not far off the mark, but in any case one would think that if radical Jews had ceased being Jews, they would have been severely critical of the Jewish role in the pre-Soviet economy. The other huge lacuna in Sleskin's presentation is that he portrays Jewish radicals as typically the offspring of successful Jewish capitalists like Georg Lukacs, who scorn their fathers and wish for nothing more than to destroy Judaism in order to achieve personal freedom and make the world safe for humanity. Marxism attributed Jewish patricide to the proletariat and urged the killing, more or less metaphorical, of the bad fathers, so as to emancipate the world from Judaism and make sure that no sons would have to kill their fathers ever again. Because he wishes to portray Jews as quintessentially modern Mercurians, Sleskin repeatedly shows how Jews dominated the economy, the universities, and the culture of Eastern Europe. Indeed, his book is probably the best, most up-to-date account of Jewish economic and cultural preeminence in Europe and America that we have. But that is far from the whole story. A prime force resulting in Jewish radicalism was the grinding poverty of most Jews in Eastern Europe. Jews had overshot their economic niche. The economy was unable to support the burgeoning Jewish population in the sorts of positions that Jews had traditionally filled, with the result that a large percentage of the Jewish population became mired in poverty, along with much higher percentages of the non-Jewish population. The result was a cauldron of ethnic hostility, with governmental restrictions on Jewish economic activity and representation in educational institutions, rampant anti-Jewish attitudes, and increasing Jewish desperation. The main Jewish response to this situation was an upsurge of fundamentalist extremism that coalesced in the Hasidic movement and later in the 19th century in political radicalism and Zionism as solutions to Jewish problems. Sleskin devotes one line to the fact that Jewish populations in Eastern Europe had the highest rate of natural increase of any European population in the 19th century. But this was an extremely important part of Eastern Europe's Jewish problem. Anti-Semitism and the exploding Jewish population, combined with economic adversity, were of critical importance for producing the great numbers of disaffected Jews who dreamed of deliverance in various messianic movements. The ethnocentric mysticism of the Kabbalah and Hasidism, Zionism, or the dream of a Marxist political revolution. Jews emigrated in droves from Eastern Europe, but the problems remained. And in the case of the Marxists, the main deliverance was to be achieved not by killing Judaism, as Sleskin suggests, but by the destruction of the traditional societies of Eastern Europe as a panacea for Jewish poverty and for anti-Semitism. In fact, the vast majority of Jews in Eastern Europe in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were hardly the modern Mercurians that Sleskin portrays them as being. Sleskin does note that well into the 20th century, the vast majority of Eastern European Jews could not speak the languages of the non-Jews living around them, and he does a good job of showing their intense in-group feeling and their attitude that non-Jews were less than human. But he ignores their medieval outlook on life, their obsession with the Kabbalah, the writings of Jewish mystics, their superstition and anti-rationalism, and their belief in magical remedies, amulets, exorcisms, demonic possession, ghosts, devils, and teasing, mischievous genies. These supposedly modern Mercurians had an attitude of absolute faith in the person of the Tzaddik, their Reb, who was a charismatic figure, seen by his followers literally as the personification of God in the world. Attraction to charismatic leaders is a fundamental feature of Jewish social organization, apparent as much among religious fundamentalists as among Jewish political radicals or elite Jewish intellectuals. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 3 of Stalin's Willing Executioners here at RadioAlbion.com.